Good day. Today is Wednesday, 12th November 2025. And before I begin this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched this programme, you've liked what you've heard and seen and choose to indicate that fact. Let me now proceed with the video itself and let me again start with a rundown of the military situation in Ukraine, because of course this is what is actually currently driving the diplomacy. And I sense, by the way, that there is now the first clear signs of panic and fear, alarm in Europe and in Britain, and perhaps before long in the United States as well, as the developments on the battlefronts intensify and accelerate. Let's first of all begin with the situation in Pokrovsk. I'm going to make a guess that at some point within the next couple of days, maybe even hours, the Russian Defense Ministry is going to announce that Pokrovsk is fully under Russian control. I think that the operation to mop up the various Ukrainian holdouts inside Pokrovsk is mostly over, and the maps that have been released by the various mapping projects about the situation in Pokrovsk itself, the town of Pokrovsk, appear to confirm this. They show the Russians now expanding significantly their areas of control north of Pokrovsk, the outer suburbs of Pokrovsk now being occupied by the Russian military. And a short time ago, the Russian Defense Ministry announced that the village of Sukhoi Yar, this is another outlying suburb of Pokrovsk in the outlying, in the lower extremity, if you wish, of the Pokrovsk cauldron, that the village of Sukhoi Yar has fallen entirely under Russian control. So it looks as if the Russians are indeed in control of at least that part of of the Pokrovsk cauldron. And as a matter of fact, just as I've started making this program, the Russian Defense Ministry has now provided us with an update of the situation in Pokrovsk. And I will read it. I will read it out briefly. They say in Pokrovsk, assault detachments of the Second Army engage in resolute offensive actions in the western part of the town, northwestern and eastern neighbourhoods of the Centralny Western District and the Western Industrial Area. Russian units completed mopping up Ukrainian troops in Sukhoi Yar. Nine attacks of the 32nd Mechanized Brigade and the 425th Scarlet Assault Regiment of the Ukrainian Army from Grishino, including attacks using armoured hardware to release the encircled group of Ukrainian troops, were repelled. 17 units of armoured hardware and up to 40 troops were eliminated. Now, what is interesting about this report, which, as I said, is brief, is that it doesn't, in fact, provide us with any accounts of buildings liberated. We've had that from the Russian Defense Ministry over the last couple of days. I spoke about the enormous jump in the number of buildings in Pokrovsk that the Russian Defense Ministry was saying had been liberated. It went up from dozens to scores, and then it leapt from scores to the multiple hundreds over the course of a period of 24 hours. This report makes no reference to anything of that kind. It refers instead to resolute offensive actions, resolute offensive actions in the western part of the town, northwestern and eastern neighborhoods of the Centralny district and in the western industrial area. The key word is resolute. That implies that there is still some Ukrainian resistance there, but it also implies that the Russians expect all of these territories to pass fully under their control within the next couple of hours or days, leading, as I said, to the announcement of the complete fall of Pokrovsk, of the passing of Pokrovsk entirely under the control of the Russians. To repeat again, most of the Ukrainian troops evacuated Pokrovsk, from what I can understand, some days ago. They fled to the eastern suburb of Mirnograd, which is located immediately to the east of Pokrovsk. These are the remaining Ukrainian holdouts in the north and in some places in the east of Pokrovsk as well. And the Russians are now saying, in effect, that they're clearing them. So that's my understanding of the battle there. Now, yesterday, over the course of the last two programs, I said that the Russians, from my understanding, were in the process of demanding or offering the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd terms of surrender, and that was basically confirmed by a large number of Russian reporting channels yesterday. And in fact, video footage appeared of a group of Ukrainian soldiers, 25, I believe, who surrendered en masse to the Russians. It's a small group. It is far from being a mass surrender of the Ukrainian forces in Mirnograd, but it does look as if a surrender, an attempt to obtain their surrender by the Russians is underway. The Russian Defense Ministry has given a brief account of the situation in Mirnograd. It says, in Mirnograd, units of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade continues to advance in the Vostochny neighborhood and in the southern part of the settlement and towards the Zapadny neighborhood. So one gets the sense that the Russians are mopping up Pokrovsk and are putting pressure on the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, are telling the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd to lay down their arms. There is a video film of the Russians dropping heavy bombs on a micro district in Mirnograd of a gigantic explosion, presumably of an arms dump there. And, well, I suspect an awful lot of that is taking place in Mirnograd. But the fate of the men, the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, is essentially sealed. Now, over the last 24 hours, the British media has made the first admissions that Pokrovsk and Mirnograd are about to fall. There were articles to this effect, focusing on Pokrovsk, which appeared simultaneously in the Daily Telegraph and the Financial Times. And these were clearly coordinated releases of information. I don't think it's just coincidence that these articles appeared at the same time. And both of them clearly were intended to prepare the British public, or at least the part of the public that is following the war closely, for the fact that Pokrovsk is about to fall. The article in the Financial Times spoke of recriminations about the battle of Pokrovsk in Ukraine, about how experts, whatever that means, in Ukraine advised Zelensky and presumably General Sirski to pull the Ukrainian troops out of Pokrovsk weeks ago, but that Zelensky and Syrsky refused, with the results that we now see. Neither the Daily Telegraph nor the Financial Times straightforwardly admit the obvious truth that there are Ukrainian troops trapped in a cauldron in the Pokrovsk Mirnograd area, but both acknowledge that the threat of encirclement is there. Of course, that has already happened, and again, as a number of commentators are pointing out, it must be frustrating for some people to read the British media about the situation in a place like Pokrovsk and see how the British media is catching up by reporting events that might have been true, say, 2 or 3 weeks ago. At that point, it did look as if Pokrovsk would be encircled. Now the British media is admitting the fact, but not acknowledging that the encirclement has already taken place. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on this. The situation, as I said, is clear enough. And as I said, we've had this information from the Russian Defense Ministry. Now, the Russian Defense Ministry has also provided us with more information about the situation in Kupiansk. And again, I get the clear sense that the situation in Kupiansk is coming very close to its end. Yesterday, the Russian Defense Ministry said that eastern Kupiansk, and that is now confirmed to mean the industrial area of Kupiansk on the east bank of the Oskol River, is now fully under Russian control. The Russians crossed the Oskol River from the west bank to the east bank, and they have now completely cleared the industrial area on the east bank. And the fighting within Kupiansk itself continues, or at least within the Kupiansk metropolitan area continues, and it appears to involve the Russians pushing south from Kupiansk itself along the west bank of the Oskol River, steadily clearing the Ukrainian forces from the southern suburbs of Kupiansk, now that the east bank and the central area of Kupiansk, the main residential area of Kupiansk, is under Russian control. And again, the Russian Defense Ministry has just provided us with information about the situation in Kupiansk as they see it. And first, we've had a comment from the Russian officer who has the call sign Lavrik. He says that assault detachments of the 121st Motorized Rifle Regiment continue to liberate the western part of Kupiansk. We mopped up Ukrainian militants in the first Zapadnaya, Zodchich, and Verbitskovo streets. We continue to inflict fire damage on the enemy, who took positions in a forest in the southern outskirts of Kupiansk and in the forest park area between Senkovskaya and Pryoskolnaya streets. As a result, the Ukrainians lost 15 troops. We are ready and able and will complete the assigned task. And then we've been given by the Russian Defense Ministry a somewhat more detailed account of what is going on in Kupiansk. They say that assault detachments of the 6th Army continue to eliminate the encircled group of the Ukrainian troops near Kupiansk. One attack launched by assault detachments as part of the Ukrainian 1st National Guard Brigade was repelled near Petrovka. As a result, the Ukrainian losses amounted to up to 50 troops and one Canadian-made Senator armored fighting vehicle. In the general area, Ukrainian losses amounted to up to 250 troops, two armored fighting vehicles, and 21 motor vehicles. So again, what the Russian Defense Ministry appears to be telling us is that most of Kupiansk now is under Russian control. There are a few places at the southern edge of Kupiansk that the Russians are mopping up, probably within the next couple of days, maybe even hours. The Russian Defense Ministry is going to announce that Kupiansk is firmly under Russian control. Now, that then begs the question of where the remaining Ukrainian troops encircled near Kupiansk that the Russian Defense Ministry is talking about are. And it seems to me that it's now clear that they are still on the east bank of the Oskol River, but in open fields, that they've been driven out of the industrial area on the east bank, that they're now in open fields, caught in the open. In other words, they still cannot cross the Oskol River or break out. And given that it's autumn and we're now heading towards winter, and this is a time of fog and rain and mud, the condition of these troops must be extremely grim indeed. So those are the two battles that have been attracting the most attention. And we can see that the situation continues to get worse and worse for them in Mirnograd now, no longer, I think, so much in Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk. The Ukrainians continue to make claims of counterattacks in the Pokrovsk area. Yesterday, they released footage of what they said was a successful tank attack in Rodinska, immediately to the north of Pokrovsk. The problem was that the video, if not exactly a fake, was misleading, because the tank attack, as various reporting channels were able to establish, actually took place not 2 days ago, as the video claimed, the people who released the video claimed, but back at the beginning of October, when the Russians were first pushing into Rodinska. For the record, I believe that Rodinska is completely under Russian control. And I also believe that the nearby village of Sharkovo, which is perhaps the more important village now, the important village that the Russians are seeking to capture somewhat to the east, I believe that that village is also encircled by the Russians, though again, it's perhaps not terribly easy to get details. The Ukrainians have also claimed that they've made some kind of an attack towards Chasiv Yar, but again, I am deeply sceptical about the truth of that too. Zelensky himself has visited Kherson, and there's film released of him that I have seen, not inside the city of Kherson itself, but at the entrance of the city of Kherson. You see the sign telling you that the city of Kherson starts here, and Zelensky speaking next to it. It may be that he did go afterwards into Kherson and that there is video footage of this, but I haven't seen it. My own opinion about that is that for Zelensky to have come to the city of Kherson in the way that he has is evidence, though obviously not proof, that the Russians are indeed now operating on the west bank of the Dnieper River, and that they are indeed establishing a bridgehead in the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper River itself. Now, there's been a very interesting article by Dr. Jack Watling of the Royal United Services Institute, which has appeared, I believe, in Foreign Affairs. And it discusses the ongoing developments in the war. Now, Dr. Watling, in British terms, is one of the more interesting and insightful commentators about the war. He, of course, loyally supports the British government and the British government's strategies with respect to the war. But anyway, he outlined the three-layered strategy that he believes that the Russians are seeking to follow. Firstly, that the Russians are aiming to conquer or capture the entire territory of the four regions, Zaporozhye, Kherson, and Donbass. And in terms of Donbass, with the likely fall of Pokrovsk very soon, and Kupiansk very soon, we see that they're moving very fast towards achieving that objective. And, well, I haven't discussed the situation in Zaporozhye region today, but the reports speak of major further Russian advances there. Radovka did a detailed discussion of it yesterday, and they spoke about various Russian plans, including an attempt, a possible attempt, to storm this town of Gulyapolye, basically on the run. I don't believe that's going to happen, by the way. But anyway, that's what they spoke about. And it looks as if the Russians have also achieved some kind of breakthrough in Zaporozhye region on the west bank of the Dnieper River, just south of the city of Zaporozhye itself, because the Ukrainian authorities have just announced evacuations of villages and communities immediately to the south of the city of Zaporozhye, precisely in this area. So we can see that Dr. Watling is right. The Russians are indeed coming much closer now to achieving their original objectives, the original objectives that they set out in the war to, in effect, clear the four regions, bring them fully under Russian control. And then Dr. Watley said that the second stage will be for the Russians to move beyond that. And, well, he made it fairly clear what the Russian territorial objectives would be. Dnipropetrovsk region, which is mostly located east of the Dnieper River, just saying, but also the southern shore, Ukraine's shore on the Black Sea, a Russian advance beyond the Dnieper towards Nikolaev and Odessa, and the capture of those places, and Russia, in effect, taking complete control of territory, all Ukrainian territory, the entire coastline of Ukraine on the Black Sea. And at that point, as he also says, Ukraine would become a landlocked country. And at that point also, the Russians would be able to exert massive pressure on Ukraine, on the government in Kiev. They would be able, in effect, to transform or regime change the government in Kiev and install a puppet government in its place. And that would then enable the Russians essentially to bring the whole of Ukraine under their control, render Ukraine into a kind of ally very similar to Belarus. Now, that might indeed be the Russian plan. I said a few weeks ago that Putin recently had a meeting with the Russian military, with Gerasimov and the other senior commanders of the Russian army who are involved in the special military operation in St. Petersburg, that before that meeting, they visited the Peter and Paul Fortress in St. Petersburg, and specifically the Peter and Paul Cathedral, where the Russian emperors are buried. And Putin apparently showed them the tombs of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, who were the two Russian rulers who brought this entire territory under Russian control, and who, in the case of Catherine the Great, established Russian control of Crimea and of the entire territory on the Black Sea, and who was the founder of the city of Odessa. And I said that all the indications were that over the course of that meeting, and other meetings, by the way, Putin essentially gave the green light to an Odessa operation, an operation to capture Odessa once the remaining territory of the four regions has been brought fully under Russian control. And interestingly, and by coincidence, last night the Russians conducted another operation, air operation with Garand drones and perhaps missiles against Odessa as well. So it's possible that Dr. Watling is right and that this is the Russian plan. But of course, as I said, the Russians don't share their plans with me, and I doubt that they share them with Dr. Watling or the British either. So we don't yet know that this is the Russian plan, but I suspect it probably is. Anyway, what was interesting for me was Dr. Watling's proposals on how to turn the situation around, how to save the situation in Ukraine. Firstly, he suggested that the Western powers, the European powers, close the Denmark Straits. He said that the West should impose, in effect, a sea blockade. He appears to believe, wrongly as it happens, that 80% of Russian oil exports, seaborne oil exports, pass through the Denmark Straits. I have to say, I don't think that is remotely true. But anyway, he suggests this. He says that there should be more action targeting Russia's shadow fleet. Well, that has been done many times. He talks about hundreds of decrepit tankers. They're not decrepit. The idea that they are decrepit is wrong. There is no record, confirmed information, by the way, of any serious accidents involving any one of these tankers. Again, I wish people wouldn't talk in this way about tankers that make up the so-called shadow fleet. The shadow fleet, as I said, doesn't actually exist. These are merely tankers that are obtaining their insurance from other sources than London. And that's all there is to say about this. And then he talks about, as I said, closing the Denmark Straits. He says this, and it, I have to say, it's a comment that left me gasping. Some European governments, including Denmark, have cited the 1857 Treaty of Copenhagen, an international agreement that established tariff-free transit for commercial shipping through Danish waters as a legal barrier to action. But this is an excuse rather than an obstacle. The countries that have a Baltic coastline today, excluding Russia, could agree to a new treaty requiring ships to meet certain standards of insurance and certification to be allowed to navigate the Baltic states, for the Baltic, for example, on grounds of ecological protection. Since the aging vessels of the Shadow Fleet do not meet these requirements. Really? What evidence is this? What evidence is that they're even aging? Some of them perhaps are, but that is true of most commercial fleets. Such a treaty would deny them entry to the Straits. This would not impinge on the principle of tariff-free transit for commercial shipping through Danish waters. That's an attempt to replace one treaty with another, excluding one of the Baltic, one of the major nations, trading nations of the Baltic, which is, of course, Russia. And frankly, I think that is completely contrary to international law. It again reminds me, and I have to say this, of these various complicated arrangements that various people have come up with to try to seize Russia's frozen assets, the various schemes that have been put together to do this. This is a scheme to basically do away with the 1857 Treaty of Copenhagen. Coming up with schemes instead of a good faith renegotiation of the treaty, which would have to involve Russia, simply demonstrates, underlines the ultimate illegality of the exercise which is being proposed. Again, this is something that many people who write about these things simply do not understand. You cannot simply get round treaties, contracts, commercial principles in this kind of way. Finding roundabout routes to do it, coming up schemes in order to do it, simply further exposes the illegality of what you're doing and proves your knowledge of it. Anyway, going beyond that, I mean, the obvious point is that the Russians would refuse to recognise this. The vast majority of countries around the world would refuse to recognise it too. China absolutely, categorically would refuse to recognise an idea of this kind, because it could be easily used to try to obstruct Chinese trade in all kinds of other places. As a number of people are pointing out, the Russians would almost certainly provide military escorts to any ships crossing the Denmark Straits carrying oil from Russia. There is no real possibility, or really no real serious danger, that Western navies would interfere with the passage of ships escorted by the Russian Navy in that kind of way. The Russians have themselves spoken about this. Nikolai Patrushev, who is in overall charge of the Navy, the Russian Navy, the Russian official who's now in overall charge of the Russian Navy, the Russian merchants fleet, and the Russian shipbuilding industry, has already spoken about Russia providing military escorts for ships. And this has already happened. Now, Dr. Watling also talks about providing further training for the Ukrainian military. They've had quite a lot of training already, and I can't say that it appears to have made any very great difference. And then again, he talks about establishing some kind of some kind of control zone some kind of operational zone in Western Ukraine by Western air forces to shoot down Russian missiles and drones. There is, as I happen to know, some talk about doing this in Britain. I gather that the Royal Air Force is far from keen. The Russians would almost certainly take steps to start shooting down any Western fighter jets that participated in operations of this kind. And recently, the Americans made clear that they're not interested in this sort of operation. And given the large numbers of Russian drones that would be operating over Western and Central Ukraine, the Western air forces would very quickly run out of expensive air-to-air missiles if they really did try to shoot them all down. These are not realistic plans. They are dangerous plans, as some people have remarked, but they are not realistic ones. They are, in fact, on their face, absurd. Anyway, there it is. When people come up with proposals of this kind, it's a further sign that governments in the West are now out of ideas. And we've had further evidence of this. There's been more information of this coming out of Europe over the last couple of hours. Now, today, the Financial Times is carrying a massive article which reads as follows. Can anything halt the decline of German industry? Europe's manufacturing champion is in free fall. Economists are suggesting radical steps to save what is left. Well, I went through the article and I get to say straight away that I didn't find any ideas at all from anybody to try to, that seemed to me to remotely come close to saving what is left. None of the radical steps that I saw seem to me to make sense. In fact, one can already see that radical steps which have already been proposed are failing. Chancellor Merz's massive fiscal bazooka, his 500 billion euro plan to build up German infrastructure, and his also massive plan to rearm Germany, is indeed generating a vast amount of debt. But as the article says, when you drill down and read it carefully, all that debt is doing is that it is being used to plug gaps in Germany's increasingly overburdened social security system, which of course now has to deal with the extra challenges of increased unemployment as industry across Germany increasingly starts to close down. And the article also speaks about how the Merz government is now having to resort to subsidies to support German industrial groups. Using subsidies in that way is a road to nowhere, by the way. It can provide a short-term benefit for industry, but it cannot sustain it indefinitely. In fact, all that it does is undermine a country's fiscal stability whilst sustaining an industrial structure which is already sagging. It is not a substitute for a proper industrial strategy. Anyway, the article is also dismissive of the entire German rearmament drive. It makes the point that the German arms industry accounts for only a very small proportion of German manufacturing, and that it simply lacks the capacity, has nowhere close to having the necessary capacity to make up for the ongoing collapse of the rest of the industrial sector. The article actually acknowledges that the number of employees in Germany's military industries is less than in Germany's toy industry. Perhaps you're not comparing like with like, and I accept that military industries are perhaps more heavily automated than the toy industry is. But anyway, you get the idea. It simply isn't possible to convert German industry to military production in the way that far too many have said. And the suggestion, the radical suggestion that's hinted at in the subtitle is in fact a return to tariffs protection. The very same thing that the United States under Donald Trump has been trying to do. I'm going to say something here, which is that tariffs perhaps could succeed, might succeed. I know there's lots of arguments and debates about this in the United States, though I have to say there is little sign that they're having a great deal of success at the moment. Industry in the United States has continued to contract. It has been in a process of continuous contraction for the last 8 months, and there are reasons to think that that contraction is accelerating. And talking about 8 months of contraction in the American industrial economy is perhaps rather generous, because I understand that what actually happened is that there was a small upward blip around the time when President Trump was inaugurated, probably caused by high spirits, when the failed Biden presidency was replaced by a new one. But the story before that blip was, despite all of the efforts that the Biden administration also made to resurrect American manufacturing, that there was a continuous many months of contraction underway during that time also. Yesterday, on the Duran, we were privileged to do a live stream with the US attorney, Robert Barnes, who has his finger, as a tax lawyer must, on the realities of the US economy. And Robert Barnes expressed the view that the accumulating data suggests that the real economy of the United States is indeed probably already in recession. Again, this is being masked by the effect of the stock market bubble, but that is probably what is actually going on in the US economy itself. So tariffs so far have not been able to turn that round. And, well, what about Germany? Well, Germany is not a continental economy, continentally sized, self-sufficient economy like the United States is. It has to import goods, commodities from around the world. It imports energy. It imports food. It imports many things, actually. It is also, by the way, now starting to run a deficit in capital goods with China, which is the first time that has ever happened. A further sign of industrial decline in Germany. As I have previously pointed out, we are soon going to find ourselves in a situation in Germany where Germany's famous current account surplus soon will become a deficit, with trade in goods likely to go into deficit also. But anyway, Germany is a trading economy. It is not a self-sufficient economy in ways that the United States could be. I have to say straight away that I think tariffs, whatever possible benefits they might notionally have for an economy like that of the United States, and I know there are many people who think that it won't work for the United States either. Anyway, I cannot for the life of me see how tariffs could work for Germany at all. And of course, if Germany is indeed thinking of moving towards tariffs, how does that work in terms of the European Union? How is that compatible with European Union law? The short answer is, of course, that it is not. Presumably, what the Germans would demand is that the entire European Union turn into some kind of tariff zone. protected tariff zone. I can imagine a mass of problems developing very fast were that indeed to happen. Either that would replicate, in fact, magnify all of the problems with tariffs for Germany that I had just been talking about. It would make them a continental problem. But I can't help but think, anyway, that there would be intense resistance from some European states if a proposal like this from the Germans were ever made. Anyway, the key point I want to make about this extraordinary article, and I do find it actually an extraordinary article, is that I was reading through it, waiting to find some mention of the proximate cause of Germany's industrial decline. And as far as I'm concerned, the facts here are absolutely clear. In my opinion, German industry was already unduly complacent and stagnating. It was not updating technologically for many decades, actually. That process got worse during the Merkel era. I discussed it many times whilst Merkel was still Chancellor before this crisis began. But on the Duran, we said, back in February 2022, when the Scholz government suspended Nord Stream 2, that this would trigger Germany's deindustrialization. And that was the single moment when this process of deindustrialization that the Financial Times is talking about firmly got underway. One can argue that German energy policy was already misguided in many ways. I know there are many critics of Germany's green transition. I know there are many critics of Germany's decision to shut down the nuclear power stations. But the reason why Angela Merkel reversed her original opposition to the building of the Nord Stream pipelines, which had been previously floated by her predecessor, Gerhard Schröder, was because after the Fukushima accident, she took the decision to close down the nuclear power stations. And she needed cheap energy, a source of cheap energy, to keep Germany running. And she turned to Russia and she moved forward with the Nord Stream pipeline projects. And they provided the cheap energy, the abundant, regular flow of cheap natural gas that enabled Germany's industrial economy to continue to function and to maintain competitiveness. And the moment that was switched off, all of the other problems that people are talking about now, the problems of the burdens of the green transition, the nuclear power plants, the loss of technological leadership, the competition from China, all of those things, which up to that point, German industry had been able to cope with, all of those things from that moment became overwhelming. And we see the industrial crisis that is currently playing out. All of that was completely predictable back in February 2022. I know, because in February 2022, I predicted it. You will not find a single reference in this long article in the Financial Times to this fact. The words Nord Stream, natural gas, Russian pipelines, none of that appear anywhere in it. How can you validly discuss Germany's industrial crisis by not mentioning this? You are ignoring the elephant in the room. I talked about Dr. Watling's fantastic ideas for reversing Ukraine's military collapse, all of the ideas for transforming Germany's industrial problems in this article are equally fantastic, because again, they don't address the underlying cause, the denial, the cutoff that Germany imposed on itself of cheap Russian gas. Now, on that point, by the way, some people in Germany do seem to be taking all of this seriously. There is said to be increasing tension between Poland and Germany about Poland's refusal to extradite a Ukrainian operative who the Germans say was involved in the destruction, the attack which destroyed the remaining Nord Stream pipelines after Olaf Scholz switched Nord Stream 2 off. Just saying. There is said to be a demand from some German prosecutors that General Zaluzhny, Ukraine's ambassador to Britain, Ukraine's former military chief, that he be charged as well. I should say that as a diplomat, he presumably has diplomatic status, so I'm not exactly sure how that would be done. And anyway, it would be bitterly controversial. But even as Germany does this, I saw that Germany has announced, in the middle of it, industrial crisis, in the middle of economic decline, that it intends to increase its funding of Ukraine. It's going to increase funding from 9 billion euros a year to 11 billion euros a year. So, on the one hand, the Germans do seem to have some understanding that maybe stopping the supply of German gas, deep down they may acknowledge that it was a problem. But they won't act on it, and they continue to pour money, money that they're increasingly short of themselves, into the very same country which they accuse of making their problems with energy worse, thereby triggering the industrial decline. So, no real sign here of anybody wanting to address the underlying problems. Now, in Britain, my own country, over the last 24 hours, there's been a bout of speculation, in fact, more than speculation. The underlying crisis within the Labour government has now exploded into the open. Prime Minister Starmer is clearly now very worried that he's going to face a leadership challenge and might soon be ousted as Prime Minister. He's begun a briefing war against his potential rivals within the Labour Party. He's particularly targeting a Labour minister called Wes Streeting, who's in charge of the health service. I cannot imagine that Wes Streeting is in any position to change British policy on anything, frankly, or make the Labour Party's position electorally any better. Why any Labour MP would think so, while Wes Streeting himself would think so, completely escapes me, by the way. But we can see how the political tensions in Britain are now also starting to get worse. The British government, like the German government, however, clueless about what to do. They floated the idea about a week ago of increasing the standard rate of income tax to cover Britain's budget crisis, which is worse than Germany's. But now they're panicking because electorally this is turning out to be deeply unpopular, as it is seen as breaking an election promise, which it does, by the way. And that's probably why we have all of this plotting going on at the top of the Labour Party. But again, nobody talks about one of the proximate causes to Britain's budgetary crisis, which again continues to be the unending flow of support for Ukraine. Now, what makes this even more extraordinary is that in Ukraine itself, there is now a massive scandal blowing up around misuse of funds that have been provided by the West. And yesterday I mentioned the investigations that have been launched by NABU and SOPA. And I suggested that perhaps it might be a mistake to think that Zelensky was the target of these investigations. More likely, I thought yesterday, that Zelensky might have himself instigated these investigations in order to divert attention away from the collapse of Ukraine's energy system following the recent Russian missile and drone strikes against it. I have revised that view. I have reversed that view completely today. More and more Ukrainian officials who are close to Zelensky are being implicated. And Zelensky himself appears to be sending officials close to him, people like the former defense minister Rustem Umerov, out of the country. He's even sent a negotiator to Istanbul to meet with the Russians to try to arrange another prisoner swap. And this all seems to be intended to try to get as many key officials as he can out of Kiev before the Nabu and Sarpo investigators close in on them. I'm now starting to think, by the way, that this thing has been building up for some months, and I wonder whether the Zelensky's attempts to bring Nabu and Sarpo under his direct control, which took place some months ago, was basically a preemptive strike, that Zelensky was aware that all of this was about to happen and wanted to gain control of these organizations so as to stop these investigations in their tracks. Within Ukraine itself, within Kiev itself, there is increasing talk that these investigations do ultimately target Zelensky himself and should be seen as part of basically an attempt to rearrange the political structures in Kiev and perhaps, just possibly, to bring the former president Poroshenko or people allied to him back in charge of Ukraine. Though quite how that improves Ukraine's prospects in this conflict now, I am completely unable to see. Anyway, I am not going to waste time debating the internal intrigues in Kiev. In my opinion, in relation to the war, they will achieve nothing. They will change absolutely nothing at all. Whatever government emerges out of the political system in Kiev, as I have said already, is guaranteed, all but guaranteed, to take the same intransigent line on negotiations with the Russians, or unrealistic line, if you prefer, in terms of negotiations with the Russians, that Zelensky himself has done. But in terms of all of this money that European governments have continued to send to Ukraine, the German government now, as I said, increasing its funding to 11 billion euros a year. The British government, I've heard that the sum that they transfer to Kiev in direct grants is something like £5 billion a year, maybe even more than that. I've heard it suggested that it's actually a lot more than that. But anyway, let's stick with that figure of £5 billion a year. The European Commission desperately hunting around, trying to find means to send money to Ukraine, coming up with fantastic proposals like the proposal to send 140 billion euros of loans raised using somebody else's money, Russia's, as collateral. I've discussed the nature of that proposal, fraudulent nature of that proposal many times. Anyway, perhaps all of these people who are sending all of this money to Ukraine ought to really consider what the information from this scandal is showing, because there are reports of hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes in cash, being found in all sorts of places, of people having salted funds away, of officials escaping Kiev before the dragnet closes in on them. I mean, the whole story is terrible. And again, it demonstrates that which everyone, of course, has always known, that Ukraine is a deeply corrupt place. And, well, no one in their senses sends vast, huge sums of money, hundreds of billions of dollars and euros and pounds of money, to a country that is both corrupt and bankrupt as well. And yet, that is what the political class in Europe continues to be determined to do. If West Treaty replaces Keir Starmer, he will continue to do it. In Germany, all of the major parties, Friedrich Merz's Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats with which he's in coalition, the Greens, they're all determined to continue to do it. In Germany, the evangelical Protestant churches have now dropped their long-standing position of supporting peace. They now say that it's proper to prepare for war. I'm perhaps simplifying what they've been saying, but it's a reversal which I find both disturbing and astonishing. And it again reflects the extraordinary change in Germany that is taking place, even as the country accelerates towards industrial and economic collapse. It, or at least decline, accelerated, maybe not collapse, its industrial and economic decline. It comes up with statements and decisions like this. There are no plans, no ideas about what to do. I've spoken many times about the necessity for governments in the West, at least in Europe, to start reaching out to the Russians, to meet with them. Well, it's now been disclosed that the Financial Times, that in fact, earlier this year, the British government did indeed arrange a call with a Russian official. The call in question was by Keir Starmer's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, and he called Putin's Chief Foreign Policy Advisor, Yuri Ushakov, and they had a conversation. And the Financial Times says that this was an attempt by Jonathan Powell to set up a back channel to the Russians. That in itself looks like a good idea. Both the Financial Times and the Russians, Peskov has spoken about this call, say that the call was a complete failure. That the way that Peskov describes it is that Powell simply repeated the usual memes and tropes and standard lines that we've come to expect from the Starmer government, that they showed no interest in any of the points that the Russians wanted to make, that there was no dialogue or proper exchange of views, and the Russians quickly decided that there was no point, therefore, in maintaining this contact. So the attempt to create a back channel was botched, and there have been no further calls since. What Jonathan Powell ought to have done was try to arrange a meeting with Ushakov. Said, you know, let's not discuss the conflict itself. Let's instead discuss ways that we can meet so that we can understand what you think and you can understand what we think. Something of that kind. But everything I've learnt about this call from both the Financial Times and from Peskov suggests that what the Russians got instead was another lecture, and it's unsurprising that they were uninterested. A back channel is absolutely needed, but it can only work if European governments and the British government understand that the current policy is sterile, that it is a dead end, that it is going nowhere. Lecturing the Russians, trying to put them on the spot, would probably not be a good idea, even if the military situation in Ukraine were different from what it is, and even if the situation in the European economies, and by the way, the Russian economy, were also different from what it actually is. It makes no sense at all in the current situation where the Russians are advancing and know that they are winning, and where our economies are in deep crisis and the Russian economy is not. Perhaps one day someone in Europe, someone in the United States, someone in Europe will understand this, and a proper dialogue, a genuine, real, sincere dialogue between the Russians and ourselves will take place. But for the moment at least, as I've said previously, there is no sign. Let me again make the point about how sterile all of this is. Jack Watling, no ideas. Fantasies about closing the Denmark Strait and shooting down Russian drones and doing that kind of thing. Things that would only make the situation worse, and much worse for us in Europe. Lectures from Jonathan Powell to Yuri Ushakov, which obviously Ushakov rejected. These are not ideas. This is not a policy. This is not an attempt to find a roadmap to bring us back to some point where we can conduct rational discussions. It's a dead end that leads nowhere, or to be more precise, it leads to that very situation that Jack Watling is talking about, where the Russians take control of Odessa and the entire Black Sea coast of Ukraine. And by the way, I strongly suspect all of Ukraine east of the Dnieper, including the city of Kharkiv, and where a government in Kiev, assuming that there's any Ukraine left, does Moscow's bidding in exactly the way that Jack Watling says. That's the only place to which this kind of approach will lead. Now, before I finish off this programme, I should say that we've had another in that truly extraordinary sequence of interviews that have been given recently by the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. And this is an interview that he gave yesterday to Russian news channels. And over the course of it, he covered quite a lot of ground. He explained that no, the Russians have not yet made a decision to resume nuclear testing, but they're very worried about the signals that are coming from the United States, and that they do indeed wonder whether the United States really has taken leave of its senses and is indeed intending to begin, resume nuclear testing. He also talked about the very difficult situation with respect to strategic weapons. He had some very interesting things to say about Venezuela as well. And he specifically mentioned the geographical factor that makes it impossible for the Russians to provide Venezuela with the kind of assistance that they provide, for example, to Belarus. I'll quote his words here. I believe it is inaccurate to compare our relations with Belarus, which is part of the Union State and with which we have synchronized, coordinated and unified positions on all key international security matters, with our relations with the friendly nation of Venezuela, which is our strategic and comprehensive partner, to which end we signed a treaty not long ago. Considering, among other things, the important geographic factor, it would be inaccurate to juxtapose our partnership with Venezuela with our union with the Republic of Belarus. In other words, the Russians cannot provide Venezuela. It is impossible for them to provide Venezuela, for geographical reasons, with the kind of assistance they are currently providing to Belarus. And he said that, by the way, in response to a question about whether Venezuela has approached Russia with a request for military assistance. The question was, has Venezuela approached Russia with a request to provide military assistance? Has Caracas asked Russia to deploy its weapons in Venezuela? And Lavrov said, no, no such requests have been made. So he went out of his way to say that Russia strongly condemns any American actions against Venezuela. By the way, on that front, the USS Gerald Ford has now reached the Caribbean, so they are there again. So who knows, maybe the attack on Venezuela is coming after all. But Lavrov made it clear that there is a limit. There is an absolute, definite limit to what Russia can do. And he mentioned the geographic issue, which I've discussed in several programs. But Lavrov also has some very interesting things to say about his interactions with the United States, Russia's interactions with the United States. And he again addressed the specific question about the so-called memorandum, the collat that the Russians supposedly sent to the United States, which apparently the Americans found far too hard line, and which, together with Lavrov's conversation with Rubio, allegedly caused Trump to call the Budapest summit off. And Lavrov, about all of that, had this to say. I would like you to take note of the item published in the Financial Times, which said that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin agreed to meet in Budapest and instructed me and Marco Rubio to prepare that meeting. Sergei Lavrov and Marco Rubio talked on the phone, but before that, the Russians allegedly submitted a harsh memorandum, after reading which the Americans decided that talking with the Russians would be pointless and meaningless. And that is indeed an accurate summary of what the Financial Times has written. And then Lavrov goes on to say this: there are so many lies here, including when it comes to the sequence of events. The memorandum the Financial Times journalists mentioned is an unofficial draft we sent to our colleagues not after, but several days before the Putin-Trump conversation. It was designed to remind our American colleagues what we discussed in Anchorage and what agreements we thought we reached. The Americans have not refuted this during the US-Russia summit. This is a point which I've made already, by the way. But Lavrov has said now in several interviews that at the Anchorage summit, Trump basically accepted Istanbul Plus, which is Russia's position for ending the conflict in Ukraine, except that there were some variations proposed by Witkoff in a meeting he had just previously with Putin in Moscow. And I said that it looks as if those that variation was that the Ukrainians would pull out of Donbass and that the Russians in return would agree to a temporary ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Lavrov is saying, is making the point that he's discussed this now in several interviews, and the Americans have never come back and have never said that anything that he has said about what happened in Anchorage and what happened between Putin and Witkoff is untrue. And he also says that the paper that the Russians sent to the Americans was a reminder of what Putin and Trump had agreed in Anchorage, and effectively a prompt to the Americans to hurry up and come back with the response that Trump promised Putin at the meeting in Anchorage. Putin came away thinking that he'd reached an agreement with Trump based on American proposals. Trump said that he would first have to discuss this with Zelensky and the Europeans. He failed to come back. He talked about sanctions and he talked about sending Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. The Russians sent this memo to the Americans saying, what's all this about? This is what we discussed in Anchorage. We're still waiting for you to get back and tell us what your comments about it are. And well, it's clear that that memo was what ultimately led to the Putin-Trump conversation, which preceded the telephone call between Rubio and Lavrov, which is supposed to have caused all the trouble. And then Lavrov also says that unofficial document did not contain anything other than what was discussed in Anchorage, which our American counterparts did not regard as a cause for rejection. Obviously not, because after receiving that memo, Trump and Putin arranged to speak with each other, and it was then that they agreed over the course of that call to have, or at least that Trump proposed, a summit meeting in Budapest. And then Lavrov continues, the president's telephone conversation was held after the document was delivered to the State Department and the National Security Council. During that conversation, President Trump did not say a word about receiving a provocative paper that destroyed all hopes for a settlement. No, Putin and Trump had a normal conversation. President Putin gave a positive response to President Trump's idea of a meeting in Budapest and proposed instructing the country's foreign ministries to prepare that meeting. That is exactly what we planned to do. And then Lavrov continues there was the call. I received Rubio's call 3 days later. We had a polite conversation without any nervous episodes, by and large reaffirming progress based on the agreements reached in Anchorage, and went off the phone. The next step was intended to be a meeting by representatives of our foreign ministry and defence ministries and possibly our intelligence services. However, the Americans have not taken the next step, although we waited for them to take the lead when it comes to the place and time for such a meeting, because it was they who proposed to hold the summit. Instead, they made a public statement that they don't want to hold a meaningless meeting. And then he mentions that whenever Rubio has talked about his conversation with Lavrov, he has said that the conversation was constructive and quite clearly showed where we stand, and there is really nothing more to be said. Well, there it is. The Russians are becoming increasingly angry about the way in which the interactions between Putin and Trump and between Lavrov and Rubio are being misrepresented. And, well, the fact that Lavrov is giving these further interviews, providing us continuously with further information, well, what that to my mind says is that the Russians have basically given up hope. They no longer trust the Americans at all. And they no longer expect Trump to honour the agreement that he made with Putin in Anchorage. Now, these interviews of Lavrov's have received no real comment or report in the media in the West. It's as if they haven't happened, and as if these remarkable revelations he has made had not been made. The damage, however, has been done, and we can see that every day now on the battlefields in Ukraine. I'm going to finish by saying that I now firmly believe that there will be a military resolution to this conflict, that the Russians will retake the four regions and do so fairly soon. At some point next year, they will indeed cross the Dnieper, not just in Kherson region, but in force, and they will eventually reach Odessa as well. I doubt myself that the Western powers will intervene militarily. I don't think they have the strength, and we will at that point have the biggest foreign policy defeat the collective West has experienced since the end of the Second World War. It will shake, it will collapse the entire international system, the whole perception of the United States as the most powerful country in the world still. I would have thought that urgent diplomacy to prevent that outcome would be a priority, but we would, as we see, there is no sign of it, and I don't believe any longer that it will come. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.